Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. School. Everyone knows the routine. In the classroom, it's the lecture. At home, it's the homework. But some teachers have taken this model and flipped it with the help of technology. Joining us now to talk about her experience with flipped classrooms is Nicole Kraft. She's a clinical assistant professor in multimedia journalism at OSU's School of Communications. Welcome to the show, Nicole.
It is a pleasure to be here.
All right, so let's first define flipped classroom.
Well, the idea behind the flipped classroom is that the time that you spend with your teachers should be spent executing the skills that you're learning. So, you know, we conventionally what we've the classic classroom model has had teachers in front of you lecturing, and you are writing notes furiously, trying to listen and write notes and not answer your phone or play on Twitter or whatever it is that we're doing now. And then you go home and you go, oh my God, how do I apply what they've told me to this assignment that I'm being given? I didn't get this down. I'm not really sure what was going on. I'm confused, so I'm not going to do the assignment, or I'm not going to do it as well as I could be doing it. I don't want to ask. I don't want to feel stupid, etc. So what we're looking to do is to kind of take the lecture out of the classroom, give it to them in an environment that feels more comfortable, more at ease, gives them more time, breaks it up into much shorter segments. We're also finding, you know, the idea of lecturing someone for 55 minutes, or I have classes that go for 2 hours, you know, to lecture someone for any length of time, they really don't capture as much as we want them to and as much as I'm sure they want to. So we break them up into small blocks of time, more chewable chunks that they can listen to at home. They watch the videos at home that are the lectures that they would be receiving in class pretty much. And then when they come into class, we're ready to hit the ground running. So because I teach journalism, I'll teach them the core concepts of the inverted pyramid, let's say. And then when they come in, now I can give them facts and say, look, we're writing the inverted pyramid. Let's see how these facts go together.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday. My guest is Nicole Kraft. She's a journalism teacher at OSU School of Communications. We're talking about flipped classrooms. That's where you can get the lecture online, listen to it at your leisure, and then do the active part of learning when you're in the classroom with the teacher. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Why did you decide to flip this class?
Well, there's a couple reasons. I ended up was incredibly fortunate to have gotten selected to go to Apple at their main offices in Cupertino last December to work on iTunes U, which is a learning platform that Apple's created. It's free. It's for the iPad or any iOS device. And it's kind of a self-contained learning environment. So it gave us the delivery platform, if you will, to put lectures with support materials. And I did it with a course that was just open to the public. It's a course I normally teach called Media Law and Ethics, but I had just a public course. About almost 15,000 people have subscribed to that course. So I started thinking there's got to be a way to use this more effectively in our classrooms and to help our students move forward, especially from a technological standpoint. As journalists, we need to be on the cutting edge of the technology that's available. And that right now is the iPad. And I thank OSU and the Digital First group at OSU because they created a grant, and that grant would put iPads in a classroom. So if you could make justification for why those iPads would be effective for your learning style, they would provide the grant and all the support technology. So I applied for and received that grant, and I was able to bring iPads in, and it was the ideal environment for this class I'm teaching, which is writing and editing for news, to put all of the course content on the iPad, all the lectures flipped on the iPad, and then they execute all of their class assignments on the iPad. So they're writing every story, doing every interview, taking photos, recording video and audio, editing all of that all on the iPad. So really, it's a self-contained environment.
Do you loan them the iPads?
The iPads are theirs for this semester.
Okay.
They take them home. And
why do you have to use iPads? I understand that that's what they used it at the Apple, where you learn to do this. But in the real world, couldn't you do this anyway and just post the lectures so that people wouldn't have to depend on that?
And I do. Actually, I have two classes that I flipped. So this writing and editing for news is what inspired me to flip the first classroom. And the more I started to realize, wow, I'm becoming much more concise in my lectures by recording them ahead of time. I'm able to re-record and think about what I really want them to have. And so before, although I only plan to do one flip classroom because they are a lot of work, anyone who's done them will tell you, I ended up flipping a another class, which is this this law and ethics, media law and ethics course. So now, in addition to the iTunes U one that's public, I've created a private one for my students, which has all the lectures and all the support materials. And then I do post all of those lectures on our internal computer system at Ohio State, which is called Carmen, so they can access all the lectures that way. So one of them is a fully flipped course in terms of it being self-contained on the iPad, mm-hmm. and the other one, the lectures are flipped and the support materials were still provided in the classroom environment. So I'm sort of doing them both at the same time.
In terms of the work, I would imagine it's a lot of work preparing lectures in advance and that sort of thing, but can't you reuse them?
Yes and no. I try to keep them as current as possible. So
making reference to current events and that sort of thing, you mean?
Exactly. Okay. So there's news stories that we talk about in the lectures that I know I'm going to need to go back and record mm-hmm. as court cases evolve. You know, of course, right now, you know, we're dealing with cases related to a variety of aspects of journalism, be it libel law or, you know, the situation that's going on with journalist privilege. And so all of these issues that are coming up, we try to keep them as current as possible. So I actually have notations of the lectures that, you know, ones that are fundamental journalism law, I can pretty much keep them the same. But as I know that cases are evolving, then I make a mark of those, and those will be ones that I revisit. I can actually, I pull them into a program called Final Cut, which is a video editing program. So I can just record sections of the lecture. It doesn't have to be the whole thing. But they're all between 5 and 10 minutes long. So even to re-record them, what I think is advantageous to a great degree to revisit the material.
If there's any listeners out there or anyone in the audience that is in a flipped classroom, is learning that way. I'm sure there's different iterations of it. Give us a call and tell us your experience, 614-292-8513. What are some of the benefits that you have seen so far?
Well, the hypothesis that I went forward with, I'm actually doing a research project related to the grant that I was awarded, was that journalism students would learn better and faster in the flipped environment and utilizing the iPads specifically. So not only would they be able to hit the ground running, but they would be able to utilize multimedia skill, whereas before we would teach them writing skill and editing skill, and then we would take them into multimedia weeks later. One of the challenges of teaching a subject like journalism is in order for you to write your first story, you need to have a lot of skill. You need to know what a story is, what news value is. You need to understand how to do an interview, how to get in touch with sources, what the stories look like, how to write in what we call the inverted pyramid of news first. To do all of that, it takes about 5 weeks in the classroom to get all of that material. If you have an hour a day, I teach 4 days a week. To get all of that in, I needed about 5 weeks. By providing them with these lectures in these smaller chunks that they could do at home, we were able to get all of that material and the iPad training in 3 weeks. And they were able to come in and do so much more writing that by the time I got their first articles, which was last week, they were noticeably further advanced than prior semesters that I had taught in their first article. They had a much clearer concept of what news was, a much clearer concept of the inverted pyramid. They understood the subtlety of putting a quote in quote marks, what that means, how to attribute that information. And you know, there's all these different pieces that go into a journalistic article. You can't throw it all them at once.
Why is that? What about your lecture online is different than the one you do in class, except for the fact that you don't have to watch the kid playing on their, you know, their smartphone in the back of the room or something and get irritated by that, you're probably cheerier.
Well, and truthfully, everyone has to tweet out in my class. So okay. we use our phones for good, not evil. I think that what's been most effective is I'm able to consolidate what they need to get in 5 or 10 minutes. And in the past, I still taught in that 5 or 10 minute block, but then we would stop and we would do some writing or we would, you know, look at an example because, again, trying to have someone talk at you for hours is exhausting. So in this way, they're able to learn it more comprehensively and more quickly because that's what they're focusing on. And they're focusing for a very brief period of time. So they really start to incorporate it into what they're seeing. And literally, they'll be listening to a lecture and looking for a story idea at the same time, as opposed to listening to me and then leaving and going to look for a story idea.
And I would imagine it's beneficial that they can stop it and go back if they didn't understand something.
Absolutely. And just what I'm looking at the plays, I mean, there's far more plays on the recordings than there are students in the class. So I know that they're going back. And the media law and ethics class, we spend our entire class period really talking about the issues. So, for example, we talked about libel today, and I could sit there and lecture to them about, we actually talked about the Hustler and Falwell case. I could lecture them about the facts, but it's much more effective, I find, for me to say, okay, tell me about Hustler versus Falwell. What were the circumstances? What did we find from this case? And then I actually gave them this quiz where they had to apply the cases that we learned and how they would apply to real-life situations. So if you are printing a letter to the editor and it's got libelous material, is your paper, could it be susceptible to libel? Well, let's look at the court cases that we've reviewed in our lectures that we did at home and how we would apply that case law to that particular situation.
What kind of feedback have you received from the students?
I have my journalism students, my writing and editing students, have been blogging for every assignment that they do, and they have been extremely enthusiastic about the flipped classroom. They feel, as it was intended to be, that they get to spend more time looking at execution with me and the concepts that they're learning. They're able to kind of bring forward into that realm of execution as opposed to sitting alone at home trying to figure out how to do things. Now we do our writing. We're really like a newsroom, which they seem to enjoy. The law class is a little bit different. It's earlier in the morning, for one thing, so they're not quite as enthusiastic. And I think that they're still... It's a more of a conceptual class as opposed to an execution class. Mm-hmm. So I will readily admit that I'm still feeling how to make it the most applicable to them so that they do feel that they are engaging with the material as opposed to just getting another regurgitation of it.
There must be some level of empowerment, too, though, because of that listening part. It's you can do it when you want to do it. You can do it when it's good for you.
And I find it interesting. They all come in with their notes.
How do you make sure they've done it?
The only way to make sure they've done it is to sit in front of them and we talk about it. And then, with the writing class, the proof is in the writing. So if their stories didn't contain the facts that they needed or the interviews that they needed or any of the other materials, then we would go back. And they'll be the first to admit we had a wonderful guest speaker with Jennifer Smith Richards from the Columbus Dispatch, mm-hmm. talking about data, which she does so well. And I said, okay, let's talk about this part that was in your lecture. And they all stared at me blankly. And after she left, I'm like, all right, raise your hand. Who did not listen to the lecture? And they all raised their hand. And I said, okay, I need to understand what happened. They said, well, be honest, we were exhausted. We did our first story and we just dropped the ball on this one. But we haven't dropped the ball. We've been doing it. And they were really chagrined about it. So, the proof for me is in their response to these writing challenges that they have in the law class. They come ready to talk. They come with notes written out similarly to the ones that they would have if I was lecturing to them, but I think they're more individualized in terms of what messaging they need to take out, and that means that they approach the cases from similar but different backgrounds, and they bring their own experiences to the table because they've had a chance to think over what they're writing and what they want to express.
Well, Nicole Kraft, thanks for joining us today to talk about this. I imagine it's something that's going to spread.
I certainly hope so. It's a lot of work, you mentioned, and this is my adventure on my summer vacation, but it's certainly proving worthwhile.
But maybe at the end of the semester we talk again and find out how it worked.
That would be great. I'd always love to talk to you, Anne.
Nicole Kraft, she is a journalism professor at Ohio State School of Communications. Coming up, we are going to talk with a journalist who's going to talk about how social media has played a role in the gang violence in Chicago. So stay with us. We'll be right back with Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the FBI released figures that ranked Chicago as the murder capital of the country. A lot of the violence that has plagued Chicago is gang-related. And in the internet age, that violence is sometimes advertised and aggravated by way of social media. Joining us now from Chicago is Ben Austin. He is a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and his article on gang violence appears in Wired Magazine. Welcome to the Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Ann.
Your story for Wired chronicles the story of two rappers from the Southside neighborhood of Englewood in Chicago and their association with rival gangs. Can you run us through what happened?
Yeah, and I think I lead with this because it's become sort of a stand-in in Chicago. It's such a well-known story, and even one repeated by the police to kind of understand reality, and it's taken on its own kind of myths. Two rappers from Englewood, a Southside neighborhood that's really afflicted with a lot of violence and other many problems of foreclosed homes and unemployment and other things. One named Chief Keef, the other one Little JoJo. Their raps, I mean, really sound like anthems for their gangs, rival gangs, and sort of the raps almost were attacking one another, beefs kind of back and forth, and all of this was going on online, YouTube, tweeting one another. Their rival cliques, really what they are only a few blocks from one another. And this escalates of kind of this back and forth, and Little JoJo tweets that he's going to be on a corner on 69th Street, and an hour later he's murdered there. So you get this sort of online back and forth threat of violence leading to real world violence, and I think that's why it's become a kind of touchstone for people.
YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram are being used by gang members. How easy was it for you to follow the breadcrumbs, I guess, online to see the sequence of events in this story?
Yeah, and I kind of stumbled on it doing other research and seeing these YouTube videos and being sort of dumbfounded. I mean, you come across kind of the New York Post story of the dumb criminal who Facebooks a crime, but this is kind of different because it's deeper into sort of just the culture. Where young people everywhere kind of chronicle their lives online. And these guys are in neighborhoods where violence and gangs, and really a different kind of gang, sort of youth gangs, cliques, that are sort of less organized, more sort of just street gangs, they're chronicling what they're doing. And so it's not very hard to find it. And then when I sort of checked in with the Chicago Police Department. They said, you know, what they do, you could just sort of punch in a bunch of key terms, you know, the name of a gang plus K for killer, or even CPDK for, you know, killing police officers. And you come across dozens, sometimes hundreds of videos. And, you know, people really brazenly flaunting things, you know, their gang signs, their affiliations. Oftentimes guns, money.
I think the word brazenly is interesting because, you know, anyone would wonder why in the world would they be doing this? And there are very complicated reasons why they do it. It's not what it seems, and that's what makes me so sad whole thing.
And that, you know, that's the joke of the internet, or the right, you know, nobody knows on the internet that you're X. Mm-hmm. So, like, the internet only exacerbates all that kind of misperception or confusion about what's reality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a danger, you know, even with a story like this is sort of you'll see all these kids, you know, it's another story of super predators. Look, you even have it here. But you're exactly right that it's much more complicated than that, that this story is a way to see the reality there that's very different, that the gang structure, first of all, is very different. You don't have kind of these super organized gangs which would never allow this kind of stuff, which would never allow lower members to display things publicly, which could get them all arrested. So that's the first thing. The second thing, this is, you know, it is effective. It's a way to get known, to build your reputation, to project power and force, to inflict fear, to recruit. To threaten others. People would take pictures of themselves beneath street signs to show that they're on someone else's turf and then tweet it to them or Facebook it. And it's also, this isn't the cause of violence or the cause of the problems in these neighborhoods, but it's kind of a symptom. And then it becomes part of the problem. It becomes an accelerator because once something is on the internet, once you do it this way, it's not just spray painted graffiti threatening someone, which 50 people might see, mm-hmm. hundreds of people might see it. And the feeling that you have to respond to a threat online when you think that that everyone in the neighborhood has seen it, or maybe even everyone in the city, is that much greater.
And we're talking about kids here using social media to make these kinds of threats. We're not talking...
Not always kids either.
But not technically kids, but youth in their way. And some of them are doing it to protect themselves.
Yeah. I mean, so you know, the feeling that if you don't project power, you are a victim. You're going to be victimized. And you better appear... show off that you have guns. Otherwise, people who do have guns, they're going to look to you as someone to attack. And, you know, people said that to me explicitly. Like, this is why I go on Facebook and I show off my guns, even though the police might see it. But my enemies will see this and think, you know, don't sneak up on this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And there is, like, this problem of perception, right? I mean, so is that guy a gang member? Is he a gangster? Should the police arrest him? If he's not, and he's doing it even because other people are doing it, or because it's sort of the cultural norm, or because he's trying to protect himself, then do other gang members think that he's somebody to attack? This is sort of the kind of the tragic aspect of perception that goes on.
You said that. By the way, I just want to remind folks that I'm talking with Ben Austin. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and we're talking about an article he wrote for Wired.com. It's entitled Public Enemies, Social Media is Fueling Gang Wars in Chicago. If you have a question or comment for Ben Austin, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Now, is this just happening in Chicago? Or?
No, certainly not. And you know, so there's two aspects to what I did in the story, which is sort of find out what's happening on the ground in the neighborhoods, and then sort of the other logical part is like, well, what are the police doing about it? So I hung out with some of the, you know, the two units within the Chicago Police Department that are looking specifically at this, and sort of have officers who spend their time looking on the internet.
I'm surprised they let you hang out with them.
They were, you know, they were sort of, they did a little bit, you know, there were some things they didn't want me to see.
Mm-hmm.
When I sat down with the head of the gang unit, he said, you know, there's some things that we don't want you to show, but he took out his iPad and he said, listen, really, a lot of it you could just figure out tooling around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take some key terms and start poking them in, and you can see. So the New York Police Department is doing even more. So this is something that you know, they credit with sort of they have the lowest homicide rate sort of in recorded history in New York right now, and they say a lot of it is because of what they're doing online with street crews. Monitoring them on Facebook, and they're actually more open. They say that they friend gang members or suspected gang members, street crews, posing as things like women, you know, pretty women and so on. So they'll, under false pretenses, engage with them. Chicago said that they don't do that or don't do that 99% of the time. I talked to officers in Cincinnati who are doing something similar. So this is happening all over the place, and you see stories of it everywhere. So it's certainly not limited to Chicago. And even like, you know, so you talked about perception, and then you led off by saying Chicago is the murder capital.
Mm-hmm.
And Chicago is getting, you know, it is right now what's going on here. Even just a few days ago, there were these, in a park, 13 shootings,
right.
Mass shooting. There's no other way to describe it.
Right.
But in terms of homicide rates, it's not even in the top 10. And in the 90s, the murder rate was almost the number of murders was almost double. So what Chicago does, it leads in absolute numbers. It had over 500 last year. That's the most of any city. And weirdly, you know, way more than New York and Los Angeles. They're doing something right that Chicago isn't doing. But it's also important to sort of think about, you know, what that means, even not just kind of build up this scary image of the place that
right.
is the worst in the country, sort of this kind of Al Capone thing.
I wanted to get back to your point that the real gangs,
yeah.
the real big gangs, the Crips or whatever they are, they wouldn't let their members do this for obvious reasons, for all the reasons why we wonder why they're doing it. There are hundreds of people out there doing this. Thousands are watching it. They are just floating around in space. They don't. I mean, are they lacking even a gang to connect with?
Well, they're so the gangs, the sort of large organized gangs, have broken up into what they are called cliques now. Sort of, there are hundreds of them in Chicago. So there might have been about, you know, dozens of sort of big operating gangs in the city. The Gangster Disciples, the Vice Lords, the Cobra Stones, these big, well-known gangs that were running Chicago. And now there's something like 850 cliques. And it's often just like, you know, kids who all grew up on a block together, or kids who all go to a school together. You know, it sounds much more like 1950s gangs in a way, you know, of just sort of how it's organized. I mean, your street, you know, and all the kids you've known your whole life. And the allegiance isn't, you know, they might be affiliated with the Gangster Disciples or another gang, but they're also sort of just feel like they're their own entity, and they're not even necessarily sort of largely making money. A lot of the violence in Chicago is being fueled by just guys on one corner attacking guys on another corner.
Just so who gets killed first.
Yeah, and I mean, this is in the piece, but I spoke to this guy, Harold Pollack, who works at the University of Chicago Crime Lab, which sort of analyzes crime in the city and looks for a lot of solutions. And he says every talk he gives, inevitably somebody raises a hand and says, who is the stringer bell in Chicago, referring to the TV show The Wire? And, you know, The Wire, which is just a few years old, he said, is just completely outdated. You know, their gangs are not organized in this way anymore. It's just, you don't see these large top-down organizations.
What is a Facebook driller, and do they exist on Twitter too and Instagram?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, so Facebook driller was a term that young people used with me, sort of describe guys who just kind of, you know, really start fights online, instigate.
Like trolls, but...
Yeah, you know, less trolls because it's maybe people they know, but attacking somebody and just sort of criticizing them, calling them out, and starting a fight. And maybe it's just, you know, sort of like you said, like, you know, what people do on the internet all the time. Maybe it's something more directed and, you know, trying to lead to real world violence, but it sometimes does. And the same thing certainly happens on Twitter. I mean, the example that we started with of the two rappers, Chief Keef and Little JoJo, all their stuff was back and forth on Twitter, including the hashtags of the other guys to make sure that they would see it. And so they were threatening one another, calling each other out, and then actually saying, this is where I'm going to be, would seem like a stupid bravado. And people watched this happen in real time, which was part of the amazing thing. People in the neighborhood, people around the city, you know, sort of we're watching this unfold in kind of slow motion, like the end of a horror movie. And, you know, couldn't believe that this kid told where he was going to be. I mean, this sort of like defied the logic of the neighborhood.
Tell us about websites like thehoodup.com and streetgangs.com.
Yeah, I mean, you know, these are kind of the you know, I compare it to sort of the Girls Gone Wild videos. You know, this is it becomes a kind of caricatured, you know, view of the violence of these neighborhoods. And I think it brings out kids sort of project a kind of caricatured view of themselves, meaning like you need to be careful not to look at this and think like this is the most nihilistic, dangerous place in the world. But kids go on something like World Star, and there's a lot of World Star Hip Hop, where they sort of run a lot of fights that happen. People videotape them, and then it leads people to kind of start fights and videotape it and shout out World Star as they do it. And it feels painful to see it, because you see guys sort of cold cocking one another and shouting this out. But it's part of this same world, that this is projecting violence and sort of on the internet. And then some of these other ones too, which actually like there feel like some gang websites where people are actually exchanging notes and ideas, and might even say things like, you know, the police are listening, but they're still kind of asking questions of one another.
You wrote that according to the Chicago Police Department, 80% of all school disturbances result from online exchanges. Once again, this isn't just bullying. This is different.
Yeah, I mean, there it may be part of it, but this was someone part of the gangs unit. He's talking about actual fights at, you know, and in a school where the kids may have to align themselves naturally with the local clique. So, you know, what's sort of just a fight and what's a gang fight gets very confusing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're all part of the school and the school is, you're either, you know, one clique or another, it's going to feel like it's a gang fight, even if it's just a regular fight or just a, you know, boyfriend-girlfriend thing. So I think those lines get blurry. But it seems like probably most disturbances in any school now, if, you know, like arguments between people, and if you went to any suburban school, mm-hmm. that two girls getting into an argument, if you looked at where it started or what played a part, you know, the internet plays some major component in it. And probably 80% is a fair estimate, or maybe even low.
What, Ben Austin? Where do you see this heading? Where is it taking us right now?
I mean, you know, this is the police are certainly monitoring this, and you know, the sort of good news of it is like that they're able to sometimes get in front of crimes before they happen. They see something like a beef escalating online, and they're able to actually look at when it feels like it's going to be real, something that's tangible is going to happen, and step in and remove someone from the neighborhood before there's violence. So that's hopeful. And there are other organizations that talk to kids in these neighborhoods and try to coach them in all sort of, you know, even kind of just social norms and, you know, managing their own tempers and also using social media. You know, this is a component that they're told about of how they project themselves, being careful with this. So, you know, obviously this is a part of all of our lives, so it needs to be managed in all sorts of ways. If I knew how to solve the violence in Chicago now, I would be sitting with Mayor Rahm Emanuel. Probably wouldn't be talking to you.
Well, thanks for talking to us.
but it's certainly
sad story. You
know, it's problem number one in Chicago right now. It's something that everyone's thinking about.
Well, we will have a link to your story on our website
right.
at WOSU.org/allsides. We've been talking with Ben Austin. Thank you so much, Ben, for joining
thanks
us.
Thanks for the great work you do.
Thanks. Ben Austin, he's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine. The title of his article we've been talking about, Public Enemies, Social Media is Fueling Gang Wars in Chicago. We'll be right back to finish up Tech Tuesday with Russell Holly of Geek.com. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Over the past couple weeks, there's been a steady buzz about the fingerprint ID technology on the newest iPhones. You can unlock the phone and approve purchases with just the touch of a finger. But if that feature can be hacked, it may not be all it's cracked up to be. Joining us now to tell us more is Russell Holly, tech blogger for Geek.com. Russell, I was so excited about this, and now I'm so scared. Describe what's going on. What's going on?
Be excited.
Okay.
You should absolutely still be excited. So there's a biometrics research team in Germany, and this has now been confirmed by another source that has found that a lot of the same tricks that you could use to deceive any biometric scanner can be used on the iPhone 5S. It takes a little more work on the iPhone 5S than it does on a lot of the other biometric scanners, but it's basically the same process, and that you could take a high resolution photo of someone's fingerprint and print it on, you know, special paper with special toner and kind of give it a latex coating and create a fake finger that you can use to trick the sensor. Obviously, this isn't something that a random person on the street is going to do, you know, by picking up your phone and doing this. And it has to be a pretty clear fingerprint. This isn't going to be like a partial print that someone got from the side of a cup or something that you've seen from, you know, CSI Miami. But it's something that is possible if you are someone who has sensitive information on their phone, then, you know, the touch sensor is not, you know, is not invulnerable. But if you're an average user who is, you know, just using it to, you know, as a phone and doesn't have, you know, mission critical or classified information on your phone, then you don't really need to worry about someone breaking into your phone using this method. It's way easier to just, you know, watch you accidentally type in your number while looking over your shoulder or something like that. But it is possible, and it has been done using a lot of the same techniques that have been deployed for every other biometric sensor in the world today.
Like when I got my fake eyeball so no one would know. That.
Exactly, yeah.
Or my new iris.
Right, yeah. So it's not something that, you know, I think most people need to worry about. I'm certainly not going to worry about it, and it is so much faster to go through certain screens on the iPhone with that fingerprint sensor. So it's definitely a pretty big deal for me.
Good, because I was looking forward to it. Not that I'm getting a new one yet, but that was a definite. That was the real thing that made it something special for me, is that component. Right.
Yeah, I mean, the whole thing, especially when making purchases on the App Store, not having to punch in my password, which is only a big deal because I have a ridiculously long password, but that's a different.
Well, I don't. It's a ridiculous password, and I hate having to remember it. And I can't tell you how many things I haven't purchased because I don't want to have to go look at that password again. So no, it's pretty exciting. So unless you're like working for the NSA or something like that, or the CIA or something, nobody cares about my iPhone, is what you're trying to tell me.
I don't think that anyone's going to take your iPhone specifically with the intent of, you know, forging a fingerprint from something that you left somewhere to break into your phone. I think that there are way easier methods that exist right now to get into that information. So,
okay.
It does exist, but it's really probably not a big deal.
Microsoft has been working to stake a claim in the tablet market and will soon be releasing the Surface and Surface Pro. We've talked about them before. What's going to be updated on these models? What are the big differences?
Tons of things. So this was actually really exciting to see. You know, the Surface Pro and Surface RT that were announced last year, I liked, but they were kind of limited. You know, and it was something that it was difficult to explain to someone why a tablet that kind of looked like just Microsoft's version of the iPad costs, you know, almost $1,000. And it was because it was a whole computer, and that was difficult to translate. It was difficult for Microsoft to explain. But we're a year smarter, I think, as a culture. We've come to see a lot of different laptops that have kind of these weird form factors with touchscreens and things like that. So the Surface is a little easier to understand. It's a little easier to digest now. And with that, you have, you know, a machine that has significantly better battery life, that's going to be running Windows 8.1, which has got a lot of optimizations that people wanted from Windows 8. And there's going to still be the less expensive version, the Surface 2, which now has a full HD screen and, you know, significantly more powerful, definitely using some much better hardware inside. So overall, they're both really significant improvements. And it was really interesting to see that this was really the result of Microsoft paying attention to all of the criticisms that they got for the previous version and really going and fixing almost all of the things that people had, you know, to say about the previous generation.
Very responsive then.
It was. It was really refreshing to see from Microsoft, who has historically not been that.
And they've paid for it. What's the big difference between the Surface and the Surface? Is it Surface Pro 2 or Surface and Surface Pro and a Surface Pro 2?
So it's the Surface 2 and the Surface Pro 2.
Okay.
They certainly haven't made the naming any easier than any other company out there to distinguish.
I'm just getting used to it. That's why I don't gripe about it as much. I'm just getting used to it.
It's just everyone now. Yeah, it's pretty much every company is doing it now.
What are the big differences between them?
So hardware-wise, when you first look at them, you're not going to see a huge difference. The Surface 2 is noticeably lighter and thinner than the previous Surface, and the Surface Pro 2. Was the big deal with that was that it was, you know, this tablet form factor that you could kind of clip this really thin keyboard onto, and they've done some really impressive things with the keyboard now. You have the new type cover is not only backlit but has extra battery built into it. So when you clip it on, you're actually giving battery back to the device. so that it'll end up lasting a lot longer. It's running a Haswell processor, which doesn't mean a lot to most people. But if you see something with the word Haswell on it, it is a significant increase in battery life and kind of processor power consumption. So, you know, when you compare laptops that are kind of on a shelf right now, mm-hmm. these new Haswell-powered devices are significantly better when it comes to battery. So while I haven't spent enough time to say for sure, it really seems like one of the biggest things that was my biggest criticism of the Surface Pro initially has been fixed in the Pro 2, in that it's going to have significantly better battery life.
And the cameras?
They did a lot with the cameras. The front facing camera, they've you know, worked with their partnership with Skype to make sure that it is a high resolution HD camera that'll work really, really well for Skype. And the back hinge on the device has two different flexing positions now instead of just the one. So they've basically gone and optimized it for you know, sitting at a desk having a Skype conversation with someone. So they've done a pretty good job with both the rear camera and the front camera to optimize for, you know, specifically for video chat. Because okay. when you have a device like that, you're not really going to be walking around taking pictures with it. So for video chat, they've done a very good job.
And there are some new accessories to go with the Surface. What's the power cover?
Well, so the power cover was what I was talking about before, the type cover with the battery. And
oh,
it's actually
okay.
Backlit keys as well. Okay. And the backlit keys dim, which in my opinion is something every laptop should have, but apparently not enough people listen to me. So
wait a minute,
don't have back a lot of backlit
keys. What do you mean?
Right. So you look down at your keyboard, and the keys themselves, like the actual letters, glow.
Okay.
So that when you're typing in the dark, which is something I do more frequently than I'm willing to admit.
gosh,
you know, you don't have to worry about. You know, straining your eyes to see the keys or kind of moving the screen down to see anything because the keys are backlit, so you can just type and go.
Well, if you learned to type in like the good old-fashioned way, you wouldn't have to worry about seeing
it. I did learn to type in the good old-fashioned way. I'm a traditional touch typist, but I damaged my arm a couple of years ago.
All right, now I feel sorry for you.
I'm handicapped.
Okay. Can't help
it. Thanks for bringing it up, by the way. I cry every night.
Okay, and then you mentioned that it's a computer. There's a desktop dock for the Surface.
Yes,
going to be released.
This was kind of exciting. This was something that Microsoft teased 2 years ago, and then it kind of disappeared. It made me really sad because I like this idea. And this is something that is potentially a really big deal for businesses who have users that, you know, have kind of the work machine that they take home. This is a dock that you can take the Surface and plug it into, and you can connect multiple monitors, traditional keyboard and mouse, Ethernet cables, even you know, separate input mechanisms. You know, if you have different microphones you want to plug in or anything like that, you can set it in this dock, and it will basically allow you to create, a traditional workstation, you know, like a mm-hmm. desktop workstation with the Surface, where everything is still running through that tablet. So at the end of the day, you just remove it from the dock, and everything that you were working on is still right there in that tablet.
That's useful.
I thought that was an incredibly useful thing for, you know, specifically for kind of office environments. And it's something that, you know, as someone who has kind of the separate laptop and desktop environment, would be really beneficial.
Yeah, I would definitely like that. Anything else that I haven't brought up? Oh, wait, there's a cover for DJs. What's that?
So this was kind of a weird thing that they threw in at the end, is kind of this experimental thing. And I didn't get a chance to touch it. Which kind of made me sad, but I'm also not particularly musically inclined, so I doubt I would have gotten much out of it. But they built a special touch cover that is for musicians, and it's kind of a mini DJ studio. It was really cool to see. They had a bunch of different options set up and individual volume controls, so that in theory, you know, someone who was an amateur DJ or you know, perhaps even a professional DJ would be able to take the Surface and plug it into an audio system and use this special type cover as a DJ station, you know, for you know, bringing in different sounds as you were going through and creating music. It was mm-hmm. really cool to watch other people use, but I was neither brave enough nor close enough to touch it myself.
Okay. We have an email from Eric regarding the iOS. I would like to know what listeners think of the new iPhone operating system. I like it. I think it is well designed and looks attractive, but a lot of my friends hate it. I don't really know why. They hate change, I guess. But my issue is but my issue is that I spent much of the past 3 months teaching my mom how to use her new iPhone. She has an iPhone 4S. I don't have the capacity or patience to teach her again. Does she have to get the new operating system or can't she stay with the old one? No, my son did not write this message. Russell, do you have to switch?
You do not have to switch. It will ask you if you want to. There are certainly a lot of really good reasons to, especially security reasons. There's some remote locking and wiping tools that are really interesting for in case you lose your phone or in case your phone gets stolen. But it is not mandatory to update. It will ask you if you want to update, and you can simply say no and have that be the end of it. That having been said, I spent a large portion of late last week putting together a bunch of tutorial videos kind of walking through how a lot of the new features work, particularly the new control center where you swipe up and you have access to all of the settings and things like that.
Yeah,
it is a lot of visual differences, a lot of visual differences. And I personally really enjoy most of them, but it is a lot of change. And especially for an operating system that has looked very, very similar for the last 5 years, it's something that's going to upset people who are, just kind of downright allergic to change.
I haven't been prompted to change.
That may be because it depends on which version your iPhone
is. Yeah, I don't
think
I changed it the last time either. So
yeah,
maybe I'm just so far behind now they've given up on me. Yeah, just so far behind. Okay, so next up. News for gamers. Remind us what a Valve Steam Box is. I do remember talking about this before.
We've talked about this a little bit before. This is something that, for people who do not play computer games, Steam is this application that acts as both a storefront and a kind of a social network and a management tool for a lot of the PC games. It is by far the most popular PC gaming platform. It's available for Mac. It's available for Linux. And it does a really great job managing games and keeping them organized and giving kind of a social layer to a lot of those games. And for a long time, a lot of people have said, man, it would be really great if these guys would come together and create a console for the television, where we kind of take those PC games and move it together. And the name Steambox has kind of drifted around for a while. And yesterday, Valve announced, kind of a big first step in that direction. With what they're calling SteamOS. It's an operating system that people will be able to install for free on computers and plug into televisions and use to play these PC games on a television, as frictionless as possible. So you wouldn't need like a mouse and keyboard for most of these games, and you wouldn't need to worry about, kind of updating the PC as you were doing this or worrying about any of the things that you would typically worry about with a Windows computer. It would be kind of a standalone box that you'd be able to set up for yourself. They may release their own piece of hardware that runs this operating system. But if you're technically savvy enough, you can install this for yourself and kind of use it on the television. The reason it's a big deal is it includes a lot of parental controls and kind of family-friendly tools to make it so that it is living room friendly. And I thought that was really significant. So if you play games on the PC and you've ever been curious about playing those games on your television, you may want to give SteamOS a look.
And what does it mean that SteamOS will be free forever? What is that?
This is something that users will be able to, download for free, install on their own hardware for free, and as updates come out, they'll be able to install those updates, without any additional charge. This is something that, is common for Linux users to a certain extent, smartphone updates and things like that. But, when you look at Windows updates and things like that, major Windows updates, usually you end up having to pay for the latest version and things like that. And that's something that they're focusing pretty heavily on here, is that you won't have to do that.
So are they a serious competitor for other game consoles? Is that what Valve is shooting for?
I think that's probably what Valve is shooting for, but that's a long road for them. I think what they first need to do is get their existing games catalog. They have a massive PC gaming catalog that they want to all be television friendly. And the truth is that most of these games, have some really, you know, specific keyboard and mouse, you know, kind of requirements. So translating that to a controller that you would hold in your hand is difficult and likely something that, that they already have seen as a problem and plan to address in the not-so-distant future. What we saw yesterday was one of three major updates over the next month and a half that that Valve is going to, you know, kind of unveil to explain how all of this is going to work. But so far, it looks like, you know, it looks like a really interesting idea to be able to take those PC games and move them to the television. And if they can do it successfully, then yeah, I absolutely believe that it could be a competitor for the Xbox or the PlayStation.
Wow. Okay. Russell Holley, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Russell Holley. He is a tech blogger for Geek.com. He joins us every week on Tech Tuesday. Thanks to everybody who listened this week. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.